Why am I scared of my health condition? Because I have a heart situation which bothers me some. I have a pacemaker that I've had a year and a half and taking other medication like Jerry is so that I don't go into atrial fibrillation. I've got an electrical problem with my heart. And my cardiologist said a month and a half ago that I was losing some heart function. Well, I told him, I said, you know, that kind of concerned me because you can't lose but just so much of that. You know, you run out of options when you get down to about zero. So anyway, that creates some fear, and I have to deal with that. The economy. My financial advisor told Barbara and I when the markets were down several months ago, he says, you're going to run out when you're 91 or something like that. I forget what. So I didn't want to. I'd like to live to be 91, but I don't want to run out.
Does he really want to live? Well, they put that pacemaker in. They told him the battery was good for 10 years. And Dick ordered a replacement right then. He said,
in fact, I told him I wanted to get two replacements, and then I'd take my chances after that. Okay, so we put down the cause of why I am fearful. And now, we do the same thing that we did with the resentment inventory. We look at those natural instincts which are threatened by the fear. And again, if you don't threaten one of those natural instincts, I'm not going to be mad at you. If you don't threaten one of those instincts, I'm not going to be scared. So let's look at the natural instincts as we know them, the social, the two security instincts, economic and material, and the sex instinct. Let's look at those and see which ones are affected by these. Barbara might lead all four of them. The social instinct, I lose my position in the family, in the community, in the church, and where I've had it for a long time. The emotional security instinct that for nearly 49 years our togetherness has provided. Material security. She's going to take some of the money.
Oh, that hurts.
Jerry will tell you she's going to take a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I put the sex instinct there because that's not as threatened as it would have been 20 years ago. But it still was threatened. Let's look at the black snake under the house. What instincts threatened by that? My emotional security. I don't feel emotionally very secure when I'm under there trying to do some work and under that house with that blacksmith.
But you can see that his emotional security does not override his financial insecurity because he could afford to hire somebody to go under there and do it for him. But that's not an option if it cost him money.
Jerry has to bring that out. They fear that I might get turned down, but seeing if I get that discharge change. I use this I've used this for a long time on this fear chart. My social instinct, my emotional security instinct is threatened if I get denied that because I still got to have that general discharge kind of hidden back in the desk drawer. My health, my social instinct is affected. My emotional security, and my material security if I can't maintain some sort of a decent physical health and be able to survive out here. The economy going down, if it was, it's not now, it's looking better. My social instinct, because I'm not able to do for my family what I want. I want to be the material patriarch of the family. My emotional security, my material security, all affected by my fear of the economy, my fear of my financial guy saying, you're going to run out. He doesn't tell me that anymore, thankfully. And then I look at column four the same way that we did in the resentment inventory. And I ask myself, what did I do that set these fears in motion in the first place? Well, my past alcoholic behavior and all of these things that impact those that are close to us is still having its effect on my wife. After all these years of sobriety, there are some things back then which still come up and still screw up a little bit our relationship. Now, I don't think she's going to leave. In fact, I'm pretty sure she's not. She can't take those 1,750 precious moments figurines in with her because
they will not fit in the trunk. I can guarantee you that of anything.
Put them in the she can't carry them off. That new Cadillac isn't big enough either for her to take them off. So. Well, I don't think she's going to. But if that was threatened, that would be the reason. Why? What did I do to set the deal in motion? Being scared to go under the house with that black snake? Nothing. I didn't trigger that doing anything. It was just there. How about the general discharge from the Air Force? What did I do? Well, if I'm going to look at it, my own misconduct when I was in there did that. Okay? How about my health? How about my heart condition? What did I do to contribute to that? Nothing. Not that I know of. It just started and it got a little worse and got a little worse and it's there. What did I do for the fear of the economy? Nothing. Oh, I might have said you could have taken your money and buried it in a coffee can out in the backyard or something, but anyway, I didn't do anything. So now we go to column 5, just like we did in the resentment inventory, and we ask ourselves where we had been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, or inconsiderate, or where we were being if we haven't got rid of these fears. And I know that in the case of my fear of Barbara leaving me, that I've been selfish with my alcoholic behavior, that I've been dishonest, that I've been self-seeking, that I've been inconsiderate, and that brings this thing about. Those are behaviors that I need to work on and be rid of. Under the house, why am I? And I didn't do anything. Well, then we have to ask ourselves what we were talking about last night. I was talking to Phil about it this morning. Have to ask myself, why am I holding on to it? Why am I holding on to that thing? Because I'm frightened and I'm self-seeking, and I don't like to go under there with that snake. I don't believe that snake's been under there for 5 years, but I didn't spend all that. I'll tell you what I've done with that. But anyway, far as the discharge is concerned, I was fearful, I was inconsiderate of myself and maybe some others. In the health situation, I was frightened, I'm dishonest, I'm inconsiderate because I'm dishonest with myself. I don't look at that thing honestly if I continue to hang on to the fear. And in the economic security instinct, I can read one right on there, I'm self-centered, I'm frightened, I'm inconsiderate. Those things bring that about. So when I do this inventory, I get something that I can work with. And I can work on my fear that Barbara might leave me. Because I know two things. I know what part of self is threatened. And I can watch that because I know that I'm thin-skinned in that area and I'm easily affected in those areas. I can try not to do these things again. And I can try to be less selfish, less dishonest, less self-seeking, and less inconsiderate. And if I am, this thing will work itself out. And I have been, and it does work itself out. You know, as I told you, April 9th, we'll be married 49 years. So something, that's no record, but it ain't bad in AA. Under the house with the snake, I tell you what I told myself, that's dumb. It's dumb for me to not go under the house and do the work I need to do under there and clean some stuff up that's under there and put some insulation back up that fell down when I had a hot water heater leak and those kind of things because of that black snake. So I just got tired of seeing this thing on the inventory, and I got tired of being so frightened about it, and one day I said, black snake or no black snake, I'm going under that house. And I went under there, and I looked around, and I didn't see him. And I worked under there 2 or 3 hours. And now, I go under there a lot to do some things that need to be done under the house. I don't camp out under there. I don't camp out under there, but I hadn't seen that in 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years. Now, that black snake hadn't been around. I don't know that he's not under there. I really don't care. My termite guy goes under there. My heating and air conditioning guy goes under there. He's never come back out and said, you know, there's a black snake under there. He's never told me that. See, I overcame that. This Air Force discharge, I used this on here, and the guy that I sponsored that's been to 15 big book studies that Jerry and I have done, he said to me, I'm tired of that showing up. And on March 3rd, 1999, he made me sign a declaration that I would get that general discharge converted to honorable this year. He made me sign it. The reason I thought I might have this general discharge changed is because I got three grandsons. Not because this thing would help me any, but because I got three grandsons, and I thought, gee, maybe one of these guys might get into and have a chance to go into an academy or something. And they get looking at the background here, this old bird's got this skeleton in his closet. Be nice to have that chain. So I made up my mind after Paul Randolph gave me that I was going to have to do something before the end of the year. And so I did, and I had some problems to overcome. One was, Dick W. and I were talking about it last night, but one was that there's a 15-year statute of limitations that I was dealing with because we're talking about 1961 to 1999. The second was that all my records were destroyed in a warehouse fire in St. Louis in the late 60s. But I had fairly good amount of these records. And so I went down to Veterans Administration, I went on the internet, I found out what I had to do, and so I put together a packet of material. And I told the Personnel Division of the Headquarters United States Air Force that I told them essentially what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had done for me and permitted me to do in the other parts of my life. And I put some documentation there. And I sent it off, and I kept getting copies of material going to the headquarters, USAF in Washington, and Department of Defense, and FBI, and some others, because I had a top secret clearance and things of that nature. Went on for several months, and no decision. And then in the summer of 2000, I got a big packet from the Department of Air Force. And there was a cover letter and said that they'd considered my situation. And they were pleased to announce that on my DD-214, and those of you in the military know that that's a record of your military service, that anything that made reference to anything other than honorable had been changed to honorable. And that they were pleased to enclose a brand spanking new honorable discharge. And the reason, they said, was a simple reason. And it's a result of this program and doing stuff like this. Believe it or not, my contribution to the community, quote unquote. So this is not a realistic one anymore. I'm just putting these two, the under the house and the discharge, here to show you what I've done with these in my own personal life. And I think you can do the same. The health thing. I can become less sensitive to this. I can have more confidence in the cardiologist. I can have more confidence in the medication, the amiodarone that I'm taking, because I'm helped. Jerry's been taking the same thing for 2.5-3 years. He hadn't had any recurrences of atrial fibrillation. Maybe I won't. I can just work on that. I'm understanding it's a problem, work on it. The same thing with the economy. I was talking to Phil earlier. I can tell you a real good thing about how to overcome some of the fear I have of the economy. I don't spend all day long watching CNBC. That's a pretty simple solution, isn't it? You don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar or a graduate of the Wharton School of Finance to figure out if the market fluctuations bothering you, don't come in the house and put on CNBC the first thing. Don't put it on at all. Go outside and work in the garden. So I've done that. Here are some of the things I've worked on in the fear area. They're getting better. I won't be totally rid of them. I know that. I can be resentment-free. Don't think I can be free of fear. Bill doesn't think we can be free of fear either. Because he says, if you'll read it, and as Bill sees it a couple of places, that in some letters A long time ago, he said that the problem of resolving fear has two aspects. We'll have to try for all the freedom that we can, that is possible for us to achieve through stuff like this. And he says, then we shall need both courage and grace to deal constructively with whatever fears remain. The suggestion is that there will always be some fear. He goes on to say that the achievement of freedom from fear is a lifetime undertaking and can never be wholly completed. He says, when under attack, okay, acute illness, or in other conditions of serious insecurity, market going down as it did, we shall all react to this emotion well or badly, as the case may be. Only the self-deceived will claim perfect freedom from fear. So he tells us we can never be totally free of fear. That's the fear inventory. Hope that's meaningful to you. But again, not only do I find out why I have an alcoholic personality and how to get rid of some of that fear that's occupying my mind so that I can't carry out the decision in step three, but it says that herein lies the key to the future. And I can look at these people and institutions. I can look at what happened. I can look at my natural instincts. I can look what I've done. I can look where I've been selfish. And I can get all sorts of information to help me take the steps 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. It's a very vital part of recovery. I say it over and over again. All recovery, in my opinion, comes from the information I gain about myself in the four-step inventory process. All recovery.
Okay, the changes we make because of the information that we have. Okay. Now, you're going to notice when you do this fear inventory, there's probably going to be a lot of repetition with your resentment inventory, because a lot of these things run right parallel, and you're going to find a lot of people appearing on both charts, and you're going to find some that appear on more than the two charts.
We're going to move right back down to the bottom of 68 and move right into the next inventory.
Okay. I wanted to just say one thing. The last paragraph in the last sentence in the paragraph before that. You know, we're now on a basis of trust in God rather than ourselves. He said, we never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. He said, at once we commence to outgrow fear. Now, that's a nice little promise right there in itself.
He said we begin to outgrow it. He never does say that we'll totally outgrow it.
Okay, now about sex.
I got the chart up. You're going to read, Jerry.
Yeah, it said many of us needed an overhauling there.
Wonder how he knew that. Wonder how Bill knew that that would be a problem.
And for all you people out here in my age, he's talking about the part that's in your head.
That's right.
Okay, he said, but above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It would be easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them?
Now he tells us here that we don't, in Alcoholics Anonymous, want to become the arbiter of people's sex conduct. We don't want to get into this business. It's too complicated. But he does say we can do something about it on this inventory process.
Okay, so we're not concerned today for all of you people that are drawn up in a tight little ball and worried about this thing. We are not going to concern ourselves with good, bad, moral, immoral, any of that stuff, because, that, like you say, we don't want to be the arbiter of anything. But one thing we really need to do, and we really need to take a hard, close look at, and the only thing we are trying to find out through this sex inventory is, what am I doing, and what am I doing to me? You know, we need to know why we're doing these things and the effect that it's having on us. Not for that, and then we'll worry about the other stuff. He said, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. And this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it.
Notice in the sex inventory that the headings take a little different spin than they do on the first two. On the first two inventories. Here they say, the first one starts out, who did I hurt? And we've put a group of examples here that might come up on your inventory. Who did I hurt? Our spouses if we're married, or our significant others if we're not, or whatever, our partners, or whoever we're close to in a relationship who I hurt. Our own families and our own children if we have any. Their families, their spouses, their children, the other person involved, their spouses, their family, their children, their friends, our own friends, others that we're involved with. You see, here's the group of people that we have the possibility of hurting. It's a pretty broad group. Again, I'll go over our own spouses, the other family, the people that we're involved with, our children, our own family. Their spouses, their family, their children, their friends, our friends. All of these people are affected, have the potential of hurting these people if I'm in unacceptable sexual situations. Next column says, what did I do? To them. What did I do to them? What did I that hurt them? What did I do that hurt them? The demands. Here's some ideas. Demands, infidelity, more than my fair share, ways, times, flirtation taken too far. Now, you women are better at this last one than we men are. Withholding. We men last less than 5 minutes in this area, usually. But these are some of the things that's possible for me to do to hurt these people over in column one. A good example that I'll use is that I go to Queen City Group, which is kind of the flagship group of Charlotte on Friday nights, and there was an Al-Anon meeting at the same time. We used to meet over in an old building, and there was a gal, young gal, of course everybody's younger than me. Her name was Tempe.
Lovely child.
She was lovely. And she worked in the same building I did, the same office building, and she was there at the meeting, and after the meeting, she hugged me at the back of the room and on her way out, and I didn't notice at the time, but Barbara was coming in to the other end of the room, see? And she brushed by me and said, let's go.
That is not a good sign.
Bad. I pick up, I think there's something going on. And as we're walking out to the car, she says, who is that bimbo? Now I know something's going on. But you see what happened? Flirtation was taken too far in that particular case. And I don't do that anymore, and it doesn't when Barbara's around. I don't do that anymore. And so I don't get in that trouble anymore. And then we look at column three, not at which part of which natural instinct was threatened, but what natural instinct, out of limits, caused me to do what I've been doing.
You know, we're going to find a big, big difference in the third column of this chart than we do any of the rest of them. You know, if I had a problem in my security instinct, it was because of my security instinct. If I was insecure, it was because of my security instinct. You know, and my social instinct screw up, it would manifest itself in a social way. But we find, because of the things that we can do with sex, and when I started looking in this chart, my sexual conduct had absolutely almost nothing to do with my sexual instinct. Because there are so many things we can do with sex. You know, us guys learned very early that the more women you can attract to yourself in a sexual nature, the bigger, greater man you really are. You know, some people call it John Wayneism. And some of the ladies have told me that they felt the same way. So you can improve your self-esteem with sex. And it has nothing to do.
And your social instinct, you can say that by buying relations, by...
Yeah, you can. That's another thing you can do. You can buy relationships with sex. Maybe you just like to go out to dinner. Maybe you just like to go to a movie or do something. And you have found that if you give sex, you can develop a personal relationship. And you can do that with it. And that has nothing to do with the sex instinct. It has to do with the security instinct and your social instinct. And there, you can buy a material security with sex. Some people are maybe in relationships that they really don't even care to be in, but they have become so materially dependent on the other person that they continue to give sex in order to receive material security. And you can do that with it. You can use it to bring somebody around to your way of thinking. Wives are great at that. You know, if you don't take the course that I suggest, then you're out in the cold. And that has nothing to do with sex instinct. It has to do with the power and the social instinct. You know, so we need to understand why we're doing these things. Why we're doing them. You know, you can use sex to get even with somebody. Say, well, by golly, they did that, so I'm going to do this. And the bad part about it, it's so stinking dumb, you can't afford to tell anybody after you've done it. So, you know, there's just so many ways that we can misuse this thing till we really need to take a close look and find out what we're doing with it and what we're doing with it. I thought for a long time I was over-sexed, and I found out that wasn't the case at all. I was just under-secure, you know, because my conduct had very little to do. And when you get this down on paper, if you're like I was, you're going to find out some things. When you start writing all this down, it looks dumb. And some of it looks double dumb. And right away, that helps. Because when I saw how dumb it looked, then that kind of relieved me of the responsibility of going out there and doing any more of it. So that helped a great deal.
One of the gals in our High Point Big Book study, which we're going to do next weekend, came up after the meeting and said, you ought to put one more thing down there. And that says, how about sex for sex's sake? Because it's just fun and enjoyable, and we got no emotion. Just for sex. Just for the good feeling. And so we put it down there. Because she likes it there, and if you knew her, you'd understand why she likes it.
And it explains.
And I kind of like it, too. I put it down there.
And there is a place in Rabat, French Morocco, called the VCS that Dick
vine
and I are both
covered,
from.
The vine-covered shack.
And it is a government-run house of ill repute, and the French soldiers get two chits a month as part of their pay to go to this place. And I would say that, you know, I thought about that after the girl said that, but occasionally there is sex for sex sake. But as a general rule, my sexual activity had nothing to do with my sex instinct.
When I was temporarily stationed at Sidi Slimane, which is not far from Rabat, as a military officer, Air Force officer, they didn't give us any chits for the vine-covered shack. We had to come up with our own. Pay our own money. What feelings did I create in others? And here's an example of some of the feelings that I can create by doing these things. Jealousy, did that with Barbara with this flirtation deal. Bitterness, did that. Distrust, did that. Anger, did that, obviously. See, I created all these things by just flirtation taken too far. good example of it, and any other things will fall in here. Then we look for at the same things in column 5 that we've been looking for all along. Where had I been dishonest? Where have I been self-seeking and frightened? Where had I been selfish? Where had I been inconsiderate? And we see these in nearly every case. If I look at the flirtation taken too far, I know that my social instinct is what makes me do that. I feel good when people see me hugging Tempe and her hugging me. It kind of helps me be a part of. And I created all these things, but I also know that I hadn't been very honest. That I'd been self-seeking, certainly. That I'd been selfish. And I'd certainly been inconsiderate to Barbara, whether she was there or not. And so these are the things that I can work on. We find these repeating themselves over and over again.
You know, the book says the exact nature of our wrongs. And that doesn't mean a life story like you write out on all these papers. What we've been looking at in column 5 of these inventory forms is the nature of our wrongs. Everything that we've been looking at in all these columns originates over here in column 5, with the exception of these few items here and there that we had nothing to do with. Okay.
So, but not only do I find out why I feel and think and do the way I feel and think and do, but again, with all of this information, if I do a good job here, I get a whole lot of information. In this lies the key to the future, the book says. I get a lot of information for 8 and 9 and 5 and 6 and 7, and you can't do a good step 10 if you don't know what kind of things were bothering you in the past. So you get a lot of information from this. Now, we seem to hurt more people in the sex area than any other area. That's why we use that form. But there is another form in your handout, which I use more now because Joe and Charlie use it, and it makes sense. And that is harms done to others outside of the area of sex. Very quickly, if we look at this form, it has the same column headings. Who did I hurt? What did I do? What part of self caused, what part of natural instinct caused me to do it? What feelings in others did I create? And where had I been over in column 5, selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate? And here are some of the people who came up on this inventory, as far as I was concerned, might come up on yours. Those people that I didn't have any resentment over, those people I didn't have any fear over, those people that I hadn't hurt in the sex area. My dad died when I was 31. He knew I was in trouble with alcohol. They diagnosed cancer in March of 1961, and 1 month after he'd retired from the Lehigh Valley Railroad, he died on November 4th. I often wondered whether knowledge of my behavior had somehow hastened his death. And I had a lot of work to do in this area. I had a lot of work to do out of the Little Red Book, because it doesn't help you out of 12 and 12, quite frankly. It doesn't help you out of here with the deceased, but it will out of the Little Red Book. And that's a non-conference-approved Hazelden publication, and I'll probably get chastised for mentioning that, but I do, and I've done a lot of work on this with that. Wouldn't have done that if I hadn't been for this inventory. My Uncle Jerry, who was very close, my dad's brother, he supported me and loved me and everything I did throughout my whole life. My mother. These are three people that were very close to me that I didn't harm in these other areas. What did I do? I thought I hastened his death. I disrupted my Uncle Jerry's life. I created sadness and concern on the part of my mother. What did I do what part of self made me do the things that brought this about? Social instinct, the emotional material, the emotional and material security instinct, and the emotional instinct and the security instinct, all brought about these things. What feelings did I create? Fear, suspicion, bitterness, sadness. Where had I been? All of these things. Dishonest, self-seeking and frightened, selfish, inconsiderate. When I harmed these people, I did a lot of harm. I was able to take care of this. I was able to take care of this. I was able to take care of this because these people were privileged to see the impact that you people had on my life, and I was able to work toward getting things squared away with these folks. Did a lot of work on it. I've been able to do this, too. and I've spent a lot of time at the Troopsville Rural Cemetery. And I spent a lot of time being sure that I made extra amends to her and to my sister, who were the closest to him when he was alive. And consequently, I've been able to deal with this. But here are some people that may show up on the inventory that we've harmed outside of the area of sex.
Okay, at the bottom of the page, it said, God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. Now, the book says this, and I question that a little bit in my own case, and I'm going to tell you why. I've been hanging around these. I have never in my life been in a sexual situation that was wrong that I didn't know it was wrong. I mean, I never woke up in a motel with some woman in the morning and said, my Lord, you're not my wife. You know, I always knew what I was doing when I got into it. It didn't keep me from doing it, but I knew what I was doing. And I've been hanging around these rooms a long time now, and I'll tell you something. If I really wanted to do something dumb, double dumb, I know exactly who I could go pick out and find, and they would tell me that it's okay. And then I felt like I can go do what I want to do and not be responsible for the decision. But we can't do that anymore. It says deep down in every one of us is a fundamental idea of right and wrong. And I believe that because we know what we're doing. Down in the next paragraph, he said, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right idea for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, for the strength to do the right thing. And then he says, if it's very troublesome, we throw ourselves harder into helping others.
Not the first time we've heard that, not the last time we'll hear it either. If this is a troublesome area, what's one of the remedies? Throw yourself the harder into working with other people.
Okay. So we get all this down. He said, if we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments
and our fears and the harms done to others in the area of sex and outside the area of sex.
He said, we have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have been hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him if you have already made a decision.
Step three.
And an inventory of your grosser handicaps.
Step four.
You have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big truths about yourself.
Covered a lot of territory in this inventory process. We hope you see how important it is and how most, if not all, of my recovery is contingent upon the information, use of the information that I gain about myself in the inventory process. Now, there was a story ran around about a gal who had been sober a little while in AA and went a few months, and she went to her sponsor and she said, I got a problem. And her sponsor said, what's your problem? And she says, since I've been sober, I don't know how to have sex. I've been unsuccessful. It doesn't seem to be working for me since I've been sober. When I was drinking, I was able to perform and get the relationships, and everything was going fine. Now that I'm sober, it won't do. And so her sponsor told her, said, well, everything to help you on sex is on page 69.
Now, I don't know whether there's any significance to that or not, but that's where it is.
So the gal went home and was looking, her sponsor told her, get out your book and look at it. But on her way home to get her book, she got these numbers transposed. And so when she got home, she instead opened to page 96 and started reading. So as you turn to 96, I'm going to read for you, and we'll show you what this gal read. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. to spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. Well, we have to add add that little humor in here, ladies. That's humor. Let's flip over to chapter 6 on page 72 into action. Not thinking.
And not not thinking into action.
He says thinking.
He said, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items
In the fourth and fifth column, we put our finger on the weak item.
He said, now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter.
We've said before that Bill doesn't like to use the same word over and over again. He uses several words and phrases here that mean the same thing. I hope you don't spend any time whatever in your group sessions worrying about the difference or discussing the difference in the term defect, shortcoming, obstacles. Bill uses all sorts of words and terms that mean the same thing. It's the information that I gain about myself in columns 3, 4, and 5. And he uses obstacles, he uses defects, he uses weak items, then he goes back and uses defects again. And he's going to do this over and over. They mean the same thing, Bill just won't use the same word.
Bill, when Bill is writing this book, he is concerned about one thing. The objects that block us off from God and prevent us from actually carrying through the decision we made in step 3. So you can call these things any way you want to. And Bill calls them a half a dozen things. But that is, in essence, what he is talking about. The defects that block us off. He said, this is perhaps difficult. Especially discussing our defects with another person.
That's he's going to devote most of his time to that. How to find the other person and how to discuss our defects with the other person. It's pretty simple, he says, to admit these things to ourselves and to God. We think we do that. But it really begins, the rubber hits the road when we get the other person and do it with the other person. Well, that's how we understand the fifth step, too.
So we think we've done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient.
We're not good at self-appraisal. If we'd have been good at self-appraisal, we'd have self-appraised ourselves into recovery a long, long time before we got here, wouldn't we? But we're not good at self-appraisal.
No, he said, many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see the good reasons why we should do so.
So he says there's some good reasons why we need to take a fifth step with another person.
He said the best reason first.
Oh, he's going to give us the best reason right off the bat.
He said, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking.
That's a heck of a reason, isn't it? It's so good, he never gives us another one. It's such a great reason that he never again gives us another one.
He says, time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they failed. We think the reason is they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until we told someone else all our life story.
Oh, that's where we get the term all your life story. And we get that confused with what they mean in step 4, but it's over here in step 5. And we're convinced that's accurate, because we're convinced that if you discuss with another human being all of the information you came up on those forms, that you have discussed, you've just shared all your life story of the things that are important, and you haven't discussed things that aren't important that may operate to cover up those things that are. He says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He or she is very much the actor. To the outer world, they present their stage character. This is one that they like their fellows to see. Notice I'm making this gender neutral. They want to enjoy a certain reputation, but know in their heart that they don't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things they do on their sprees. Coming to their senses, they are revolted at certain episodes they vaguely remember. These memories are a nightmare. They tremble to think someone might have observed them. As far as they can, they push these memories far inside themselves. They hope they will never see the light of day. They are under constant fear and tension, and that makes for more drinking. Now, psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We spent millions of thousands of dollars for examinations. We know a few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder that many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance of recovery.
How many of you ever went to a psychiatrist, paid him $100 an hour, and lay there and lie like a rug? Yeah, buddy.
So you're going to start off with a paragraph or two here on telling us how to select somebody to take a fifth step with. Now, folks, remember that this book was written in 1938. There were 40 or 80 or 100 folks spread between Cleveland, Akron, and New York City, so it wasn't easy to find somebody to take a fifth step with. Folks, I hope you don't find this a problem today. If you can't find somebody to take a fifth step with, you're going to the wrong group. You're associating with the wrong people. You ain't got a sponsor. Because I don't know of anyone that would be more appropriate to know all of this stuff about me than the guy that I'm going to be whining to in the future, who can use this information to help me. But he's look at this in the framework of 1938 and see what he says.
Okay, he said, if we expect to live long or happily in this world, 74. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession must and, of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it.
That's still a valid suggestion today. You might choose to do this. If you belong to a religion that uses confession as a part of, you might choose to use this today. It's still valid.
Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics.
That's still valid today. If you opt to choose a counselor or a religious, or somebody in organized religion who's a professional at this and does a lot of it, that's certainly a valid suggestion today.
He said, if we cannot or would rather not do this, we search our acquaintances for a closed-mouthed, understanding friend.
That's still valid today. You might choose a closed-mouthed or understanding friend. So these things are still valid today.
He said, perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person.
Still valid today. You might want to consider one of these two people to take a fifth step with.
He said, it may be one of our own family.
Now, Bill's probably running out of good ideas here.
You do this at your own risk, and like Dick says,
I can't imagine in 2004 anybody opting for this for this category. But
you know, with all of the strength of the fellowship, the strength of the fellowship that we have now is a pitfall if we get caught up in the fellowship. But because of the strength of the fellowship, it makes this part of the program so much easier, because there are sponsors. And I suggest you do this with a sponsor, because one of the prime things we're trying to do with this thing is extract truth from it. And just because I put the plug in the jug and wrote down some inventory forms, that doesn't mean that I am necessarily qualified to do all of to quit doing all the lying and the justification that I've done for years and years and years. Because I had to, in order to live with myself. I'm not going to know what the truth is when I get all this stuff written down. I am going to need somebody who is strong in the program, who is going to help me assess what I have wrote down. I would tell him, I said, no, I was just being frivolous over here. He said, no, you weren't frivolous, you were dishonest. This is why you did this. And if you, I would suggest highly that you do this with your sponsor. And if you have a sponsor with whom you are not comfortable doing an in-depth fifth step, you may have the wrong sponsor.
Top of page 75, first paragraph.
He said, when we decide who is to hear our story, we'll waste no time. We have a written inventory and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it.
Now, if you fix your sponsor, he's not going to be surprised. Or she's not going to be surprised. You don't have to tell them in great detail what you're about to do and why you're doing it. They know full well. That's one of the advantages of having your sponsor do it.
Okay, next paragraph. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We can begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe.
These are some promises right up here in the fifth step. There are some promises right after I take the fifth step. We don't have to wait till after step 9 for the promises. Here are some right here in step 5. How many of them are there in the next? How many pages?
There's 32 between here and page the ones we read in the book. If you want, between 75 and 85, there is 32 promises in this book. If you want to take one day and dig them out.
Sounds to me, if I read these correctly, that the spiritual awakening has already begun to happen right here. Doesn't it to you?
He said, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour.
Okay, an hour. The second time that Bill gives us a time frame. After you finish your fifth step, we know you'll be tired and exhausted. The fourth and fifth step has been an arduous process. You had to spend a lot of time, a lot of mental energy, emotional energy, and that you're tired. So in the book, Bill gives us a time frame so that we can get our things back together and kind of get on another path here. So he says that we'll be quiet for an hour.
He says, carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. Are we building an arch through which we shall pass? For we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skipped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand?
Well, I was looking for my arch chart overhead again. I can't find it. Pull your arch, go back to your arch chart in your book. I may find mine before I quit fumbling around here, but go back to your arch chart in the book, and I told you that Bill would come back and refer to this again, and he does. And he's telling us here, he says here that, again, he confirms what I'm building. I'm building an arch through which I will pass a free person. And this is not the first time he's mentioned the ark. He mentioned it when he talked about the keystone in step 3. Now we finish step 4 and 5. He knows the alcoholic. So he tells us in this particular paragraph, check yourself. Check your work. Have you omitted anything? Because you're building this ark through which you'll travel a free person. Is your work solid? Are the blocks 4 and 5 firmly in place, lined up? Are the stones properly in place? Or have you left them a little cockeyed? Or you left them a little off center? Check your work. Have you skimped on the cement and the foundation? Bill knows that we're alcoholics and we have a tendency to skimp on cement. We're alcoholics. He knows we try to make mortar without sand, take shortcuts. So he tells us to check your work at this point. Very important juncture. We want to make sure that your work's solid so far. So if you look at step 4 and 5, see they're properly lined. Have you tried to make mortar without sand? Have you skimped on the cement? If the answer is no, they're properly aligned. I'm skimped on the cement. I've not tried to make. I didn't take any shortcuts here that I know of at this point. Then you're ready to move on.
He said, if we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable.
Now he uses another term. See, he doesn't use defects or shortcomings or weak items. He refers to the things that we have admitted are objectionable. Same things he's talking about. The information in steps in columns 3, 4, and 5.
Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing.
Now, this is all there is to step 6 in the big book. That's one paragraph.
That is all there is, but I'm going to share this with you from my experience. The step 6 and 7 are probably two of the most misunderstood steps in here. Become willing to have God remove our defects and humbly ask Him to do our shortcomings and the wording of the steps. But, you know, I thought for a long time that there wasn't anything wrong with me. And then when I got here and I first read this part, I said, well, if God will just give me the $29.95 makeover, you know, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to say, okay, God, take all of this, and that'll be the end of it. But I'm going to tell you something, and this is a hard thing to say, but it does not work that way. It doesn't work that way at all. A personality is nothing more than a set of mental habits. You know, I've been sick, and I've had defects a lot longer than I drank. We develop our personalities when we're growing up, and to give you an example, early on in my childhood, I did something that wasn't right, and my mother asked me, said, did you do that? And I said, oh no, I lied. And I lied to escape the consequences of my action. My lie originally was a solution to something. And then lying became the problem. Because I tell you what, if you escape the consequences of your action and you do that by lying, that is valuable information to a potential intellectual alcoholic like me. I file that up there in my head. And over a period of time, lying became a part of who I was. And when I started trying to acquire things that I didn't feel like I was going, that were going fast enough to suit me, dishonesty became a part of who I was. Because I used this over and over again to get things that I didn't have any right to. So, really and truly, do you know how I got sick? Do you know how my personality got so screwed up? I worked at it hard over a long period of time. And as a result of that, of those actions and decisions that I made, this lying and inconsideration and self-seeking and being frightened and all of my defects that show up in column 5 became a part of who I was. So there's a couple of reasons I might not want to get rid of these things right now. And there's some fear attached to this when you get to step 6. Because if I'm going to have to be totally honest, how am I going to get what I want? You know, I don't know that this will work. I've never tried being honest before. How am I going to get the things that I need if I'm always just worried about other people and being considerate of other people? How am I going to get what I want? I've never tried this before. And it's a little bit frightening. And besides that, some of the little lesser things that we do are kind of fun. You know, you can...
Some of the more important things we do are kind of fun.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Some of them are kind of fun, too. But I found out what I have to do in step 6 is I cannot get rid of these defects. And without me, God will not get rid of these defects. So it's a joint venture. Without me, He won't. And without Him, I can't. So in step 6, what I have to do is I do turn these things over to God. I turn them over and I ask Him to help me to be a different person. Help me to overcome the defects that I have found in column 5 of these inventory forms. So the way I do that is when situations come up where I've always had a tendency to be dishonest, I ask Him to help me be honest in these situations. And today, if situations come up like that, I try very hard to be honest where I have always been dishonest. When situations come up, I try to be considerate of other people and their feelings. And the times I've always been inconsiderate. And if I always ask God to help me, and I do this, and I work very hard on these defects with God's help, over a period of time, consideration will become a part of who I am, just like inconsideration did. Honesty will become a part of who I am, just like dishonesty did when I was doing it all by myself. So you see, this is not a magic wand deal like they tap you on the head. This is a process, and it takes a long time, and it's a lifetime thing. I keep doing it every day. I'm not as good at it as I'd like to be, but I'm a lot better at it than I used to be. So do we see how we can change these personality things by asking God to help us to be rid of the things that we found out that are destroying our life that we have come by on these inventory forms? Don't do the things that you've always done. As long as I keep doing the things I've always done, I will always be the person that's so screwed up and the reason that I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous to start with. So the first thing I have to do is don't do the things that I've always done. Okay.
Two steps that Bill put in here under God's guidance that night that were not had that didn't have any previous basis in the Oxford groups. These were the first two. Put them in there because he didn't think there was any way for the alcoholic to jump from the fifth step and all that information that we've shared all the way to the amend step without trying to do something with that information that we'd disclosed on the inventory and discussed with another person. Step seven is one paragraph too. It's a prayer. It says, when ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you will remove from me every single defect of character. Now the step says shortcomings. Why does he use defect of character? Because there's no difference which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. And that's all that there is to step seven. These two steps have a paragraph each. Maybe it's because Bill, at the time of the writing of this book, didn't have a whole lot of additional information to put down on these two steps. If we'll go to other writings, especially the 12 and 12, which was written several years later when Bill did have a lot of information about the need to be willing to have these removed and humbly asking God to remove them, you will find some very valuable and lengthy discussion about these two steps.
Okay, so step seven says that we do the things that we don't want to do. We do something different. We ask God to help us be rid of these defects. So the six and seven process, I just said in step six, we don't do the things that we've always done. When situations come up, we don't do the things that we've always done. That is the first step. The second step is we make ourselves do the things that we don't want to do. Like I talked about honesty and dishonesty. Before, when I was dishonest, I have to quit being dishonest. I have to stop doing that. That's the step six part of the process. And step seven is I have to ask God to help me to be honest, and I overcome these things. You know, it's a personality is almost like a body. You're and losing weight. You know, there's a formula for losing weight. You know, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to quit eating like you did. I've lost 50 pounds, I bet you, 15 times in my adult life, and I always did it with the idea that when I get to where I want to be, I can eat anything I want to. Not remembering that eating anything I want to is what got me to the point where I needed to lose 50 pounds. So I have to quit doing that sort of thing. So I quit doing the things that I've always done. And in step seven, I ask God to help me do the things that I don't want to do. Like in diet, you know, I've got to quit giving up and the garlic bread by the bowlful rolling in butter that I love so much. I need to quit eating those things. I have to make myself not eat those things. And if I want to lose weight, I have to make myself eat salad with Italian dressing or oil and vinegar rather than blue cheese like I like. I have to make myself do these things. So if I can just quit doing the things that cause these defects and ask God to help me do the things that counteract them, because I'm not going to want to do these things. But if I can get Him to help me do these, gradually, over a period of time, the personality change that all of the doctors are talking about in this program will occur. Well, on my way.
Take 7 minute smoke break. A seven minute that looks like this.
And 14 seconds.
5 and 2. So we can get on to step 8.
Now, what did you say? You said personality.
All right. This, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory.
How about that? Now, we wouldn't have had this list if we'd have done ahead inventory, but we found out that the inventory is the key to the future, and a lot of the folks and institutions and principals that we got to make amends to are going to show up on these inventory forms.
Okay. He said, we subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes.
Little eight-step prayer there where it says we always use prayer. Every little prayer with all these steps.
He said, if we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any length for victory over alcohol. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order. But this is not an end in itself. And this is great. It says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Two purposes. Okay, now we're talking about step 8. It says, become willing to make amends. There's two things I want to tell you about step 8. Well, three, actually. One of them is what I've already discussed, and that is sponsorship. Please, for Pete's sakes, do this with the aid and assistance of a sponsor. Two other things. One is overkill. One is overkill. If there's anybody on this list anywhere that you think you might owe an amends to, put them down.
Better to put too many down and with your sponsor's help call out some than it is to leave somebody off the list that's very important to your continued sobriety and needs to have amends made to.
And you might wind up and they're eating your lunch and you won't know how and why. But overkill is a good thing. Another thing is, if you're a keen intellectual alcoholic like I am, if you look down this list of people that you owe amends to, they fall into some different categories, you know. Some of them are pretty easy, you know, like you want to get your mom speaking to you again and things like that. Some of them you're just willing to make. And you'll have several of those, and you'll have several that you say, well, you know, I probably beat up on them a little bit, and they beat up on me a little bit, and I may or may not. I mean, some of them I'm going to do later. I know I'm going to make amends to them, and I'm going to do later. And some of them, they beat up on me pretty good, too, so I may or may not make amends. But if you're like me, you're going to find 1, 2, 3, or 4. Ain't nevers. I don't care what the program says. I ain't never going to make amends to these people. And if you are like me, you're going to use one of these ain't nevers. And you're going to say to yourself, well, if I can't do the thing like I'm supposed to, I won't do anything. And I will use that as an excuse not to do this part of the program if I'm not careful. But what you do is do this.
This is not a hand. This is not a part of your handout, something we use, though.
Just take your legal pad and draw a line down through the middle and then split each one of those columns. It makes you 4 columns. And all of those people that you're comfortable making amends with right now, put them in the left-hand column, the right nouns. The group that you are you're willing to make later, put them down as laters. And then when you get all of those listed, put the maybes on there. Put them down in the next list. All right, in the next column, ain't never. Let me tell you what's going to happen if you're like most of the people that I talk to. You're going to get into this amends process. And you are going to see the benefits of this program. You are going to get some wonderful response and some wonderful feelings from this amends process. And you're going to start feeding on that. It's almost like an ulcer. You know, you feel good, and that's going to make you work harder, and the work harder creates things, and it makes you feel better, and you're going to really get elevated when you start doing these things. And you're going to run out of these right nows, and probably short order. And then you'll say, well, I'll get on some of these laters. And one day you're going to look down and you say, well, I don't have any more of them. And say, well, let's just try one of these maybes. And you're going to go on down through there, and one day you're going to find out that all you've got maybes are done. And then one day you're really going to be feeling good, and you'll say, just for the heck of it. Just for the heck of it. Let's try one of these ain't nevers. And you make amends, and if you're not really careful, one day you're going to wake up and find that you have completed your amends list. And you're going to feel so good till it's unbelievable. Because you're not doing this now by yourself. You know, in our promises, it says we're going to be amazed before we're halfway through. You know where that is? That's right between the laters and the maybes. Because they don't tell you that what we read in the promises in our program is the results of working steps 8 and 9. So, have we got this? So Dick's going to tell you how to do all these.
Yeah, I'm not going to be able to tell you how to do it all together, but I'll tell you what the book says about it. The first thing it did, it just told us what our real purpose is. And if anybody asks you what's our real purpose for doing these things, for doing the program as we have done it so far, but especially in the repairing the damage of the past. This is clearing up the damage of the past. Is two things, so that I can be one of maximum service to God and two, maximum service to the people about me. Notice he doesn't say who those people are. He uses the word people. And so I guess that's everybody. He doesn't say my close friends or the people in AA or my closest family. He says the people about me. So that's pretty broad. And that's one of the real purposes that we have here. Down further on, he said he's going to tell us how to approach some of these people. And we're going to go through this very quickly because you'll find in the next few pages how to take the ninth step. Now, he mixes 8 and 9 together. He'd do the same thing in the 12 and 12. Just hard to keep those two apart. And he does it here. It's hard to separate out steps 8, which said we made the list, and step 9, where we became willing to make amends to, and where we made direct amends. But he does talk about some things here, which we'll point out in the next few pages. We just tell you, go on and read these pages, and it'll tell you, and you get some help from your sponsor on how to make the amends. Once you make the list, how to make the amends. First thing is that step 9 says we made direct amends. Wonder what that means. Wonder what direct means.
Eyeball to eyeball.
Eyeball to eyeball. Now, somebody may say to you, well, can I make amends over the phone? And the answer to that is, if you harmed them over the phone, you can make amends over the phone. Now, there are some where we need to make amends phone because you can't get to them one-on-one, where we need to write letters because we can't get to them, where letter writing might be, in rare occasion, a better vehicle to make the amends. But the book says direct, and that literally taken as eyeball to eyeball. The reason why that's good advice is that then and only then can I tell exactly how the amend was received. And whether or not I need to do any more work on it or whether that's finished. And I think that's important. Because let me tell you, folks, what these two steps do for me. They permit me to function out there in the world without any emotional turmoil that's created by baggage and difficulties of the past. Do you remember... You remember the telephone ringing and how that didn't bring any good news and you didn't want to answer? You remember that? You remember the doorbell ringing and the feeling in your belly? Remember car door slamming in the driveway and that feeling in your belly? Remember something coming in the mail? Not good news, was it? When did envelopes, they always come then. Not good news. Stuff cleaned up. Remember going... down the sidewalk and seeing somebody where there was unfinished business and that feeling you get in your stomach. Hard to stay sober with that coming back all the time, isn't it? Well, these steps permit me not to have that recurring because I clean up that wreckage. And I'm going to tell you that it can be done. And we're not going into all the details. You just have to work your own 8th and 9th step program because you know the people you've harmed and what you need. But ask yourself this question. What do I need to do so that when the telephone rings, I can be, feel just normal? When the doorbell rings, I'm free and I welcome anyone who's there. When a car door slams in the driveway, the same with the doorbell. I feel good. Somebody's coming to visit. I'm not worried about who that is. When I get a piece of mail, I'm not worried about the postman bringing some kind of news and some stuff that I haven't cleaned up. I want to be able to be in a crowd and be out there and function in society and not run into somebody that's going to cause me to shrivel up. It's that lump in my stomach, that football in my stomach, that lump in my throat. Get down so I'm not sticking out above the group. Cross over to the other side of the street. When I can pull that off, I can be really happy. I can live out there with society. These are very important steps. How can I function in the real world without those things that make me uptight because of the wreckage of the past that I haven't touched? We got a chart that we use to explain these steps and do a little review of where we come from now. It's your next handout. We show why we're doing this. Now this, you know, remember what he said earlier on when I said my theory was always that if I get feeling better physically, then I can deal with the way I feel emotionally and mentally and work on that. Once I get those two working where I feel pretty good physically and I'm thinking pretty good, then I can work on this spiritual deal a little. But that's not what he said. He said if we straighten out spiritually, if we get okay spiritually, we straighten out emotionally and physically. So it's an inside-out job. And here's how the target thing works. First off, with steps 1, 2, and 3, admission of powerlessness, admit that I need a power greater than me, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to that power, I get right with God. And then I move into the next circle, which is the mental emotional circle. And I take 4 and make an inventory, take 5 and I take 6 and I take 7. I get rid of that baggage, I turn it over to God, I share it with another human being, and I get right with myself. And then I move into steps 8 and 9, the social, the physical social area, and I get right with the world about me. And that's the 3 dimensions of life, 1, steps 1 through 9. That makes my life whole. I'm right with God, I'm right with myself, and I'm right with the world about me, with my neighbor. Now, how do I know that this is important? Because 2 times Bill has mentioned something that we're going to point out here. He talks about the 4th dimension of existence. The 4th dimension. I wonder where that is. I bet that's out here. He talks about the realm of the spirit. I'll bet that's out here. He talks about God consciousness. He's going to talk about that some more in what we read. I'll bet that's out here. Now, what's the difference between this, 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 and this area of the 4th dimension of the reality of the spirit out here? No limitations. There's no limitations out here.
I had an old sponsor one time used to tell me the sky's the limit.
Now, unless you think this is new stuff, I'm not conducting a church service here, but I'll show you where it's not, where this is not new stuff, and this is not your handout. But there was a great